This is the Taxpayers Federation podcast, where we are fighting for lower taxes, less waste, and more accountable government. I'm Chris Sims. I'm the Alberta director for the CTF. I'm joined today by my good friends, Franco Terrazano. He's there in Mordor, also known as Ottawa. He's our federal director. And a special treat from the province of Quebec, Nicolas Gagnon. He is our Quebec director for the CTF. Thank you both for joining us.
It's going to be fun.
Yes, it will, because we're going to talk about EVs, electric vehicles, how much we're shelling out for them, when the deadline is, all that great stuff. So who wants to kick this one off when it comes to electric vehicles, the looming ban on our regular cars that use gasoline and diesel, and how much this is costing taxpayers so far?
Well, 11 years from now, you will have no other choice but to buy an EV. That's exactly what's going to be happening. That's the current state of the policy that has been put into place by the Trudeau's government 2 years ago. And the thing is, it's going to come to a colossal cost for taxpayers from many angles. And for now, it's very hard for us or for anyone in this country to really figure out how much is really going to cost us overall. But there's many ways for us to actually have a small brink of it. The first thing is, there's two ways for the current government to go forward with this whole policy. They want to both stimulate the supply and stimulate the demand of new electric vehicles. So they found a very original tool that I've never heard of before. It's called subsidies. And apparently it's a very new stuff that is original from that government. And they found those three ways. They were going to subsidize both the construction of new electric factories or electric car factories. They're going to subsidize the production of new electric batteries and electric cars. And they're also going to be subsidizing incentive to buy those EVs. So that cost along is really ludicrous at this point, because we already know for sure that all of those new electric batteries and electric factories that they're currently announcing, Stellantis, Volkswagen, Honda, all of those, they're part of this policy. Why? Because they need to ramp up the production of those electric vehicles by the next 10 years. So they're pumping additional taxpayers' money into those different factories in order to get them running by the end of the decade. We already have a report from the Parliamentary Budget Officer last year that is telling us that all of those factories will take almost a generation before we taxpayers see a return on investment or even the break-even point. But it's not just that. We also, like I said, we're subsidizing up to 30% the production of every single batteries. And finally, for every car that are being purchased, yes, we're subsidizing them as well. $5,000 every time that someone wants to buy an electric vehicle, here you go. The government is subsidizing you that purchase. So that's just one piece of the puzzle. But one thing for sure is that we're going to be driving more and more in that direction over the next decade. It's going to be costing billions of taxpayers' money. And that's just for the part of the production and the part of getting those electric vehicles to the market. Now, it's not just about getting them to the market. It's also making them run or for you to be able to drive. And here's the thing. There was a report that was published by the Fraser Institute a couple of months ago that is literally telling that if we want to keep aim to that goal, that by 2035, 100% of the cars on the road will be or electric vehicles or hybrids, it's going to mean that we're going to have to increase by 15.3% the overall energy production in Canada. That's like adding 11 new mega hydroelectricity barrages in Canada overall over the next 10 years. And just to give you an example of what they base those figures on, it's all based on the Site C in British Columbia. Site C in British Columbia took approximately 20 years to build. It's able to produce up to 1,100 megawatts, but it took 20 years to build and cost over $16 billion to taxpayers. And so imagine that figure multiplied by 10 or 11 over the next 11 years so that we're able to sustain the whole energy need for those additional electric vehicles on the road. Clearly, none of those figures have been provided by the federal government so far. When Trudeau made that announcement 2 years ago, he never mentioned anything about the overall taxpayers' cost when it comes to, building those electric vehicles factories, subsidizing them, the purchase, or even making them run on the road. So overall, that's a massive cost. And the lack of transparency of the government at this point is very insulting for all of those taxpayers that will have to bear the burden on their shoulders over the next years.
Yeah, Nicholas, I just wanted to jump in on that with the power consumption requirements. The Fraser Institute does outstanding work. But I was talking to a scientist in BC, and he was saying, wow, they're really being conservative with even that amount, because he's done the math as well. And even just for British Columbia, just for personal transportation, not touching industry or agriculture or government, it was going to require 9 new Site C dams just for BC. For personal transportation. And again, this is a guy, you know, we disagree on the carbon tax even, but he has done mega analysis on this stuff. And so, yeah, great work by the Fraser Institute, but they're really lowballing, apparently, the amount of energy requirements that would be needed for everybody to suddenly switch to an electric vehicle. Now, Franco, like, do we see this actually happening? Are we seeing a pushback happening in Ottawa? Is anybody standing up for people who drive a regular vehicle? I mean, you'd have to pry my 1990s Chevrolet out of my cold, dead hands.
Well, I mean, of course, the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, like on so many things, are really leading the charge against this crazy government that sometimes I feel wants to tax cars and trucks out of existence. You know, yeah, I only get that feeling. But like, I just want to kind of go into some of these numbers here, because Nicholas, like, just really understands this information. But I kind of want to just break it down a little bit, folks, right? Because there's kind of two issues at play here. One is like the massive subsidies. And we've seen the massive subsidies, especially in recent years, like $13 billion for the multinational corporation Volkswagen, right? $15 billion for the multinational corporation Stellantis. Recently, $5 billion for the multinational corporation Honda. Right. And we're talking like more than $1 million a job before I hear people say, well, what about the jobs? What about the jobs? I mean, it's a cost to taxpayers of more than $1 million a job. But not just that, like these billions and billions of dollars coming from the government isn't falling out of the air. Right. All of that money is being picked from the pockets of Canadian workers and Canadian businesses. So at the very best, it's a shell game where the government is taking money and jobs from one part of the economy and giving the buckets of cash to the boardrooms in Germany and Japan. But that's at best. Realistically, what the government is doing is harming our economy, because, like, think of the incentives at play here. They're not looking at economic incentives. They're looking at political incentives, right? Let's cut some ribbons. Let's smile for the camera. But given their political incentives, I mean, you might as well just send these politicians and bureaucrats to the casino. They probably get a better return on our money that way. But I also just want to mention what Nicholas said about the break-even point, yeah. Right? The PBO said, Nicholas, what, like a generation for these factories to break even. Now, first of all, I think they're going to break even sometime between a generation from now and never, probably more towards that never end of the spectrum. But like, think through what the point that Nicholas is making. Break even on a so-called investment in a generation. Not like get returns on the so-called investment in a generation. Break even on the so-called investment in a generation and sometime between then and never. Now, Nicholas, I just really kind of re-detailed the subsidy part of it, but can you just like go back to the basics for the people who are listening, what this ban on gas and diesel cars in the future is? Can you just break down those details for our listeners?
Yeah, well, it's definitely important for them to understand that it's going to affect directly their life, not just in terms of the cost for taxpayers in the whole, because of course we can talk about the fact that we're already overtaxed and that we're sending all of those tax money to those German and Japanese companies, of course, but it's not just that. It's also the cost of energy that will be increasing over the next years, because if we need to add additional energy infrastructures, yes, it will mean that the bill, that the energy rates will increase as well, and that is mostly part of all of those projections that has been done over the last years. But then again, yes, we're increasing the cost on them, but we're also reducing, well, quite literally their freedom, because in about 10 to 11 years, you will have less cars or less vehicles available or less options when you go to the car dealership. And of course, that cost will be on your shoulder. Right now, if you look at the current numbers, the average cost of an electric vehicle in Canada is around $73,000, which is a lot, which is way more than the medium after taxes salary of a family, or the medium income of a family in Canada at this point. So most people can't buy an electric vehicles right now, and they really have a hard time figuring out if they'll be able to buy one in 10 years. And the truth is, the more it goes, the more the affordability crisis is going on, and the less people are seeing that it's really an option for them or even something that they should be looking for. There's clearly other needs. There's clearly other problems that people are looking at. They're trying to buy a house right now. They're trying to pay their rent. They're trying to pay their groceries. So to buy an electric vehicle that is seen by many as a form of luxury is kind of forcing their hand. But the government is there. Well, if you don't have the means, here's $5,000. Here's some other people's money so you can buy yourself a car that you don't need or that you don't really have the means to buy. So all of that altogether is really going to be crushing taxpayers over the next decade. And that's something that people should be figuring out right now and that the politicians should be careful about too.
So Nicholas, though, I just want you to break down so our folks can just hear how crazy it is. Like, what is the federal government proposing?
Well, it's basically simple. In the next, by 2026, 20% of all the cars that you will find in the car dealership will be electric vehicles. In 2030, it will be 60%. And in 2035, no more gas powered vehicles, no more diesel powered vehicle altogether. So that's going to be, that's pretty much a regulation as it is right now. So you have basically 11 years to, well, get ready to buy an electric vehicle or, well, be in a situation where you will have no other options or you will be forced to walk, basically. But that's how the government regulation is going to be happening that over the next coming years. And so by 2026, really, we're going to be seeing the effect of this policy right on the spot.
This is just a disastrous amount of interference. Even if you set aside the cost directly to people, if they were forced to buy an electric vehicle, just think of the industry, right? Like, a lot of people maintain their vehicles very well that use gasoline and diesel. They can trade parts out. They can swap them. There's a huge parts demand. There's secondary mechanics who keep these things on the road, all this stuff, right? If you take really good care of your vehicle, we see them with classic cars driving around, even from the 50s and 60s. You can keep them running, but I've heard nothing but complaints from people, especially mechanics, on how much it costs, for example, to buy a brand new battery for one of these things once it starts breaking down, how much it costs to install it, how much it's going to cost these mechanics to go to trade school on how to actually repair these vehicles and keep them on the road. And if you're talking about an environmental cost, right, that's a huge environmental cost. If you have to just go crush this thing down at the wreckers and go buy a brand new one from a dealership every 10 years or so. So I really wanted to get to this energy demand part because I think this is something the government is just refusing to answer. And to put a pin on it, like, here in Alberta, if we get blackout warnings, for real, well, I get a warning on my phone a few times a year saying, don't use your hairdryer or your oven to cook your kids' supper because we're this close to having a blackout on our power grid. And that's just with people mostly driving regular cars. Franco or Nick, has anyone in the government given like an adult response, like a grown-up answer to the question, where is all of this energy going to come from?
Well, I would say that in Quebec, we have a very similar situation, if not worse situation. Sadly, we don't necessarily have the adult in the room right now that is telling the government to please change the current orientation. It's not going well. The thing is, for example, in Quebec, we have Hydro-Québec, which is a state monopoly for all of electricity. And we know that by 2027, 2028, it's not very far from now. It's like three or 4 years. We're going to be losing all of those energy surplus we used to have and we used to be bragging about over the last couple of decades, and that's all going to be gone before the end of the decade. And yet the Quebec government has the same goal than the federal government when it comes to EV transition. So they're also subsidizing their own ways. They're also giving incentive for the purchase of electric vehicles, and they're also dumping a lot of taxpayers' money on new electric factories project like the one from GM, Ford, and most recently Northvolt, very close to Montreal. So all of that is still happening, but sadly there's no real big discussion about where is going to be coming the new additional electricity production. Now there's a discussion that is slowly starting about the nuclear potential in Quebec, but we're very far from getting any close to getting one built at this point. It's mainly just the debate, and we're still 10 years from having those EVs on the road and having the new policy going forward. So that is a big problem that is going to be hurting Quebec very soon if no one is doing a 180 on that policy. Clearly, if we have to first have this discussion about adding an additional energy input in the energy grid before even talking about the whole transition, or else we'll be stuck in a situation where we'll be deciding who has energy and who has not. And that is the current state of the situation in Quebec, because Hydro-Québec is losing more and more its ability to provide energy to the growing demand in Quebec. And so you will have different companies that will come in the province and will say, well, there's not enough energy for us. We're going to go somewhere else. That's basically, well, they already have other reason to go somewhere else. They don't necessarily want to pay as much taxes as they do in Quebec, but the energy crisis will just add another problem, another additional burden to all of those companies. And yes, this can hurt the economy as a whole.
You just said it there when you said 10 years. This is going to be the case in 10 years. 10 years goes by like that. By the next election, Trudeau would have been in for 10 years. So think of it that way. That's how quickly 10 years can go by, and it's going to affect something as essential as your personal own private vehicle that is parked at your house, how you get around, how you get to groceries, how you get your kids to school, how you go to work, how you go on a road trip, Franco. How do you manage to go on a road trip? Now, did you want to chat about the Green Slush Fund? I will be honest, I haven't had a chance to even crack this thing open in Ottawa. I'm going to put on my rose-colored glasses here and give the benefit of the doubt. Is the Green Slush Fund meant to answer the question we've been talking about here on where this magical electrical energy comes from for all of our electric vehicles? Is that the solution to the problem?
You know, to Chris and anyone else listening, like, before I get into that, like, if you thought that the Arrive scam debacle was like surely as bad as it could get when it comes to government waste, where, you know, a simple app that costs $80,000 to initially launch ended up costing $60 million. Well, if you thought that was as bad as it could get, wrong, because introducing, ladies and gentlemen, what the government has called the Sustainable Development Technology Canada. Okay. So now it's bureaucratic garbledygook for a corporate green slush fund. This slush fund has doled out more than $800 million in taxpayers' money to these clean tech companies, green tech companies, since 2017. Now, the Auditor General just released a damning report. It is bad. It makes me sick to my stomach. This green corporate slush fund makes me want to green out of my mouth, i.e. puke, okay?
Now, you can see the emoji right now on our chat. That's great.
This is so bad. So the Auditor General's report found that $76 million from this taxpayer-funded green corporate slush fund, $76 million went to companies where conflict of interest rules were not followed. Okay? 90 times that happened. Folks, let me put a little bow on it. That's tens of millions of dollars, taxpayer dollars, to companies that had ties to its own directors and managers. $76 million went out the door where there was conflict of interest rules that were not followed. Not just that, folks. $59 million went to companies that were ineligible.
How?
Like, think about how gross this is. How but gross,
like,
this is.
But like, how? How did the money go to them if they weren't eligible?
Great question. Now, the Auditor General, the report is so damning. And then, so just a little backstory. This initially was brought to light from some whistleblowers within the government who thankfully were like taxpayers are not being protected here with this green slush fund. Now, after there was some hay made because of these whistleblowers, kudos to them, the government decided to halt all funding from this green slush fund back in October. They said, okay, this is even this government was like, okay, this is a little too crazy for us. maybe we should just cut back. So they halted the funding in October. Now, this Auditor General report comes out about this green corporate slush fund, tens of millions of dollars to companies where conflict of interest rules weren't followed, tens of millions of dollars to companies that were ineligible. Okay, so what does the government do? What does the innovation industry minister Champagne do after the scathing Auditor General report? Well, he decides to immediately resume funding through this green slush fund. Pinky promises that we'll do better this time. And then, as a final situation, says that they will end the slush fund, kind of, but by bringing it into another arm of the government. So the slush fund will be disbanded over the next coming months, but the program funding through this slush fund isn't going away. They're just bringing it inside to another arm of government.
So they're still going to blow taxpayers' money.
Correct. Correct.
But it's just
correct.
Coming out of a different bucket with a okay, this is way worse than I thought it was. Like, I was guessing a few million dollars, like, it's still bad. Oh, my gosh.
No, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars over the last couple years. I mean, really billions of dollars since this slush fund was first brought in like two decades ago. So this is huge. So I just want to clarify, right? So they halted the funding back in October. After the AG's report, they said we're going to immediately resume funding through this green slush fund. And then in the coming months, they're going to bring the slush fund into another arm of government called the National Research Council. Okay. So essentially, this fund is living on just by like another name. And the government is trying to assure Canadians saying, hey, don't worry, by bringing the slush fund into another arm of government, there'll be proper oversight. And I'm saying BS. And you know why I'm saying that? Because this government has given every reason for taxpayers not to trust them to have proper guardrails. Let me just talk about two other things that recently happened. I already mentioned the Arrive scam, right? Where that was under government control, right? And it went from an $80,000 initial app all the way to $60 million. That's not proper oversight. Oh yeah, the government bureaucrats working on the app took $340,000 in bonuses. Here's another example. Remember the COVID subsidies, the tens of billions of dollars that went out the door? Well, there was 30 plus billion that were questionable subsidies that, you know, including hundreds of dead people getting the CERB, hundreds of minors getting the CERB, hundreds of people who are either in jail or outside of Canada getting the CERB. So I'm just looking at this government like, no, you can't just bring in the fund and then, you know, wash your hands and congratulate yourself on the back and say, good job. What I'm saying and what the Canadian Taxpayers Federation is saying is that turn off the taps, completely defund the green slush fund.
Oh, no kidding. Like, okay, you touched on a few of the waste things there. And on the COVID element too, don't forget, folks, that the Public Health Agency of Canada dumped almost all of the national stockpile of PPE into a landfill before the pandemic hit and never bothered replacing them. Again, those are bureaucrats whose job it is to oversee this kind of stuff. And it still is a dumpster fire. The very idea. So for folks who don't know, like, the National Capital Region is basically the city of Ottawa and a little bit across the river in Gatineau. And these departments almost always are physically in a building. Okay. So just because you're moving this green slush fund over across Bank Street to a different building, and it's now landing within their budget parameters, that does not magically make it more accountable or better or okay. This is one of those things where you're trying to hide the ball under the same colored shells. Oh my goodness, that's way worse than I thought. So do we have any hope of having this reined in? Like, did the Auditor General say this thing should be powered down? Do we think they might power it down and stop funding it if we get enough people to yell at them?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, I really don't have a crystal ball. I am glad to see that this report has got a lot of pickup and we're really putting a spotlight on like how brutal this corporate slush fund is. Now, as I mentioned, the government doesn't seem like it's going to end this slush fund, right? They're just saying, well, we're going to resume funding and then bring it into the National Research Council, which does not go nearly far enough, right? Like, the taps need to be turned off. It looks like the Conservatives, though, have been jumping all over this thing. They've been making stink about this. So there is, I guess, a possibility that when they come in the government, they should totally scrap the green slush fund and any funding associated with it.
Now, this is one of those hangover things. I often describe it as a hangover of government policy, and I'll explain why. So in Ontario, years ago, under the Liberal government with McGuinty and Wynne, they had this huge green energy scandal that might ring some bells. So very quickly, on average, say your power rate was 2 cents per kilowatt hour, they signed in some cases 30-year long contracts with solar and wind companies for 80 cents a kilowatt hour. Who is making up the 78 cents? You, the ratepayer, the taxpayer. They were completely screwed, way overpaying, billions of dollars. People couldn't afford their power bills. And now it's the Ontario taxpayer who are carrying the bill here. My point of all of this is it gets really dangerous when a government has a goal like we're going to get rid of regular vehicles and only have electric vehicles. So if they make that their goal, anything they dump into, say, a green slush fund in order to make the environment better doesn't get the scrutiny that it needs. It provides this big smokescreen. It's this big cover fire. And so again, this is one of those key moments where we have to hold government to account and say, no, you guys can't just pick these pie in the sky ideas and then dump hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars into some ideal that won't actually work out. Are we good with the green slush fund, or do we want to get to our taxpayer pro tip, Franco?
Well, we are not good with the green slush fund. We want to axe the green slush fund, but we do also want to get with the taxpayer pro tip. And I'll go first. It's pretty short and simple. Now, folks, you know, we've been praising the parliamentary budget officer for a long time for calling the Trudeau government out on its BS. I mean, holding it accountable is what I really should say. So you remember us referencing the fact that there was a PBO report that showed that when you look at all the different costs of the carbon tax throughout the entire economy, through the entire cost of living, that the carbon tax is costing average families hundreds of dollars more than what they get back in rebates every single year. Well, let's just call it how it is. The Liberals have been going after the PBO on its analysis. So they've been attacking or at least trying to discredit the PBO's analysis. And, you know, I heard in, I believe it was a parliamentary committee where the PBO was talking about the analysis and essentially said that the PBO's analysis is in part based off the government's own analysis of the economic costs of the carbon tax. And the PBO even went along the lines of saying that there was a gag order on the PBO not to disclose the government of Canada's own carbon tax economic analysis. Right? So, hey, Liberal MPs, Liberal government, the government, show your math. Release your economic analysis of the carbon tax to the Canadian taxpayer, to Canadians. We deserve to know the analysis that you've done. And the PBO makes it very clear that there is some data, there is some analysis on the economic cost of the carbon tax that the government is not releasing. So taxpayer pro tip, let's be open and transparent with Canadians. Release the analysis.
Amen. Nicholas, what's your taxpayer pro tip?
Yeah, well, we've been talking a lot about electric vehicles today, but I think that the vast majority of Canadians are still driving their gas-powered or diesel-powered vehicle at this point. As we all know, we've been able to get some nice victories in some provinces regarding gas tax cut. I'm talking here about Manitoba, Ontario, or Newfoundland and Labrador. So it's clear that many people are looking forward to have a gas tax cut this summer. It will be very great for them. Clearly, many of the Canadians will be on the road. And so it's very I think it's the best time right now for those federal politicians, the one in Ottawa right now, to consider giving a tax cut to those people that will be stuck on the roads, to those drivers, to those motorists, those families that will be going on road trips. We know for sure it's going to be helpful for them. We have seen the effect of a gas tax cut in many provinces and how much that's been helpful for families. So clearly, the pressure that we have been able to apply on those different jurisdictions has worked. And it's clear for our folks, for our supporters, that if we continue to fight towards that, if we continue to pressure our federal politicians, we will get it. So let's get it done. Let's continue to send the message and let's keep the pressure on so that we can have some gas tax cut this summer.
Yeah, for an entire year, we didn't have a provincial gas tax here in the province of Alberta. We were saving 13 cents a liter. It would be really nice to see that happen here again in the province of Alberta, especially in time for rodeo season this summer. My taxpayer pro tip is a very practical one. I'm encouraging all of our listeners to follow a guy named Dan McTague. If you don't follow him yet on X or Twitter or online or whatever, do so. He was a longtime member of parliament for the Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin Liberals, big fiscal conservative. And what his specialty is predicting what tomorrow's gas price is going to be. And he's almost always bang on. And so it's just a super practical tip, because he'll sometimes say, hey, wait to fill up because you're going to save 5 cents by tomorrow. And he's almost always right. So you're definitely going to be saving at the pump. So go follow Dan McTague. He's with a group called Canadians for Affordable Energy. Also some pretty sharp analysis on electric vehicles. Folks, if you have any questions for the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, or you want to know more information, head on over to our website, taxpayer.com, sign our petitions, and join the taxpayer army.